When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to this new episode of The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast. I'm Tom.
And I'm Kate.
And Kate, you are sitting shivering in your executive chair down here in the podcast room.
Because of extreme aircon. And it reminded me that Nile Rodgers claims to be able to hear music in the air conditioners. And then that made me think that there's an amazing song by Warren Zevon, which actually has an air conditioner that appears in the end, but it's just in the form of a chorus of all his voices singing an amazing tune.
Amazing.
But I can't hear any music in this one.
What music does Nile Rodgers hear in an air conditioner?
He can hear like a chord change. So if there's a thing, basically he claims to be plagued by music.
Doesn't he just hear his own music in everything?
He does. He walks around singing his own music. And then when he's in a hotel room, he's like, hey man, I can't concentrate because I can hear the music. So it might all be bollocks, but I quite like the idea.
Music-wise, what are we going to be talking about?
We are going to be talking about the human cyborg that is Janelle Monáe, who's got a new album out next week, first in 5 years. It's called Dirty Computer.
We're also going to be discussing the new Amazon Hulu series. Well, actually, it's just finished, but it's all available to watch. The Looming Tower, which is about Al-Qaeda and the road to 9/11.
We're going to have another non-anniversary, the non-specific cultural event.
And as a little bonus, I'm going to give you a taste of a conversation I had with the novelist Jim Crace about his latest novel, The Melody, and about the liberal instinct of fiction. And it's more exciting than that sounds, I promise. So Kate, Janelle Monáe is about to release her first album, what you just said, five years, is it?
Yeah. So she claims to have had the concept for this album before she even began The Arc Android, which is, of course, the incredible double concept album that came out sort of roughly 10 years ago, which is the one that had Tightrope on it, which is the thing that made her famous. And I still feel physically sick when I watch the video for Tightrope because it excites me so much. So Janelle has this thing about like a real marriage of the visual and the audio. So she calls these videos that she makes her emotion pictures. Mm. And I think Tightrope is still a good example of how closely the visuals are tied to the sound. Because if you listen to Tightrope, it doesn't have the same effect. You have to watch this bizarre film that's made in a deserted mental home
with the Palace of Dogs
with members of Outkast in it and her incredible sort of black and white tuxedo working aesthetic and her classy brass and the Metropolis horn section and very, very strange thing. And it still has a kind of, an extremely exciting effect on me when I watch it.
So. Well, maybe we can come back to Arc Android, which is incredible. She's released, I think, a string of three singles so far this year. And Make Me Feel, Django, Jane and Pink, which fits in with that emotion picture thing. And it's got a very thoroughly thought out conceptual video, I want to read out the Wikipedia description of the video, which is sometimes worth doing. The plot finds Monáe and Thompson, that's Tessa Thompson, the actor who is in Black Panther and Annihilation and appears in lots of Janelle's stuff. The plot finds Monáe and Thompson, along with a group of other women, dancing in a desert, having a slumber party, and sitting out by a pool while expressing appreciation for the vagina.
Is that all it says? Yeah. So it doesn't mention the fact that they're wearing massive vagina chaps, the incredible trousers that kind of go around in an arc, which are bright pink of like varying types of pink. Yeah, it's very, very direct, very simple concept. I think this is something that's happening with Janelle. Janelle is still a sort of a work in progress. It's kind of amazing watching it evolve. It's very complicated. No one quite knows what it is yet. But there is certainly, like, sonically, there is a simplifying of her output. And you can hear in the three songs that have been released so far, it's clean, very catchy electropop compared to this sort of, you know, extremely baroque stuff that she was coming out with a decade ago.
And I think that's equally true of her new single, just released, I Like That. Sometimes I want to roll or stay at home, walk in contradiction, get some factual and fiction. A little crazy, little sexy, little cool. Little rough around the edges, but I keep it smooth. I'm always left to center, and it's right where I belong. I'm the random minor note you hear in major songs. And I like that. So Kate, you were just saying how her sound's evolved a bit and kind of she stripped it down a little bit. What's interesting is that doesn't mean that she's sort of narrowed the range. It's still like a kind of amazingly broad range of stuff. So just in these four songs we've had, Make Me Feel, which is a complete Prince number. I mean, it's like it seems to directly riff on Kiss. Yeah. She was working with Prince on this album before he died.
Before he died, or as she puts it, passed to another frequency. This is how she speaks. Yeah. She speaks in like retro futuristic psychobabble. Yeah. You can't get any sense out of Janelle, as brilliant as she is.
And then we've had Django Jane, which is a sort of is a rap track, very self-assertive. Remember when they used to say I look too mannish, stuff like that. And the video is a kind of bunch of girls following her black leather clad posse.
Yeah, and my favourite line, I've got no space left on my damn bandwagon. Which also I think is a bit of a stretch, because in a way she doesn't have a bandwagon. She is kind of unique and there aren't really people copying Janelle, but you know, it's aping that kind of like tough rap, you know, ego rap, which she can do, but it doesn't necessarily suit her as well as the sort of more political stuff that she does.
She seems to always be doing it with a raised eyebrow, which I still quite enjoy. The other great line in Django Jane is, hit the pause button, let the vagina have a monologue. Then you've got Pink, which is this kind of, again, like quite minimalist electropop. Grimes is on it. Then a weird sort of poppy, almost hands in the air chorus. And then I Like That, which we just heard a clip from, which is that kind of R&B skippity hi-hat stuff with that lovely spoken word section where she remembers a child in her class in, like, I don't know what grade it was, in math class, telling her that she was weird and that she and rating her a six
when she cut her perm off.
Yeah.
There was when she came out, there was a feeling of a extremely elaborate, brilliant sort of almost student art project to it. It was the Wonderland Art Society was her kind of coterie of black and white clad men and women. And they functioned out of a house in Atlanta. It was basically just a house, but it was sold as this very mysterious kind of factory that was creating this music and this aesthetic and everything. And when you would go and see her in those days, like about 10 years ago or something, it was weird watching her because it was completely brilliant, but it was also slightly shambolic. So she had this phase where she would have an easel on stage, and while the music was playing, she would draw a naked lady. Like, she was like sketching a lady, and then she would like tear the lady off and give it to a member of the audience. And there was that, just those, that beautiful sense of when very, very bright, driven people have their first project, they throw everything in it. And it's hard to know exactly what's going on. And there is kind of a sense of almost real-time emergence of someone who's finding what they can do best and slimming things down. And also, of course, she's in a very good position because she was doing this sort of Malcolm X-type protest music, but quite subtly protesting music before Black Lives Matter was a big thing. And now Black Lives Matter is big. Beyonce's all over it. So she's got on that bandwagon herself. And so now she's getting the international superstar press interest that maybe she wasn't getting at the start.
Yeah. I watched a video which I hadn't seen at the time from 2015, I think, which was after a big Black Lives Matter protest. She did a track called "Hell You Torn About." Did you ever see that?
No.
Actually, it's like it's a straight down the line protest song, and it's just a chant basically, where using the names of some of the people killed, you know, by white American police over the last couple of decades. It's incredibly effective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and possibly bolder and more direct than you've seen people like things done by people like Beyonce. But you met her.
Yeah.
You?
And she was intimidating. Like, she had her stooges were all around her. Her stooges were part musicians and part bouncers, and they had, you know, earpieces, and everybody. It was a classic case of, if you want to be a star, you have to behave like a star from the start. I mean, Freddie Mercury used to get people to open doors for him when he was a student. Because once you set that up as being your expectation, everybody kind of like follows in your wake, you know. And I had to go and interview her, but she chose to do the interview at the David Bowie exhibition at the V&A. So again, I'm going to be allying myself with one of the greatest shape-shifting characters in pop music.
When was this?
This was 2000 and, gosh, like
13
or something.
Yeah.
And from the start, she went straight in at the top, and her mentors were all the biggest men in pop. They were Stevie Wonder, Prince, and then she was getting these comparisons to Bowie that actually the journalists made.
Right.
And then she reacted to the journalists' comparisons.
Okay.
It was really interesting. So we had to go around this Bowie exhibition. He was still alive. And we were looking at Gilbert and George's piles of oranges with, of course, audio headsets on. So how can I interview her when she's got headset on? It was really annoying. I was having to look at her face and try and work out by the line of her eyes what bit of text she was reading and make some assumption about her from that. And I kind of followed around all afternoon. And eventually we got back into this kind of people carrier with all her stooges. And as soon as she started talking to me, they brought their film cameras out and they filmed. My interview became their property. It was incredible to watch. Everything that I was doing for the purposes of the article, they had on tape, recorded, and they could do what they wanted with it before I could. And then I got her in a hotel room for like 10 minutes, and it was like talking to Prince or something. It was just, she talked about being an alien and time traveling and all that kind of thing. And it was just brilliant. And underneath that, I could feel that there was a quite nervous young person who was trying to figure out how to be famous, how to be tough, and how to act and not fall into the category of new favorite female pop star who's going to be pitted against Rita Ora or something like that. So she kind of kept herself very quite masculine and quite separate from the whole kind of arena of female pop stars that were big at that time.
So that's interesting that, as you say, she kind of allied herself to male figures in a way.
Yeah.
And I think it was... I think it was Big Boy of Outkast who was one of her sort of mentors in the early days.
Yeah.
And then obviously Prince.
Exactly. So she had Outkast already making her music with her.
Yeah.
And then she had the advice. She sent her first album to Prince and Stevie Wonder with a handwritten sleeve notes on it, you know. So she knew where she was going.
And what's the thinking behind, because she started her career from the very beginning with this bizarre Cindy Mayweather narrative about a sort of Blade Runner mixed with Metropolis narrative about some android who falls in love with a human, and then there's bounty hunters sent to like shut her down. And this isn't just like a little 2-minute skit at the beginning of a record. Like, she's properly tried to work this through her first like two records. It's all or three records.
If you think about it, she came out around that period, 2006, 2007 or whatever, in the era of female alter egos in pop. So she was totally...
Sasha Fierce and stuff like that.
And maybe they were sort of slightly later, but it was reflecting something that was going on.
Yeah.
But what she seems to do is she reflects what's going on, and she does it in more depth with more energy and more obsessive detail than other people are doing it. So Cindy Mayweather was, I mean, I used to kind of understand that story, and now I haven't got a clue what it's about because it's so long ago. But yeah, there was that sense of... If you're going to do something, do it properly. That seems to be what she's all about, which is why now she can be political, because she can be more political than Beyonce, because she was always, I don't know. I just feel like there was an undercurrent. There was something that she wanted to do along the idea of, you know, race politics. And she wasn't maybe necessarily able to do when she started out. And now she's actually quite outspoken and quite overt about that stuff.
I mean, is she a megastar? Like, no. What's her level? What sort of level are we talking about? Like, who would you compare her to?
I was thinking, she's almost like a Solange type right. character, because she's made interesting, complicated music in an era that values that, but it doesn't necessarily turn up in the charts. Mm. And I think it does more now. But Solange, it knew the right people, obviously. Did her.
This is Beyoncé's sister.
Did her interesting stuff and is now considered really like highly respected as a musician and sort of megastarish, but not really a pop star. I don't really feel like Janelle is a pop star. So she's actually kind of landed on her feet. At one point, it looked like she might be, I don't know, moving into acting. You've seen her in.
Oh, yeah. She's in Moonlight. She's amazing in Moonlight. And she was also in Hidden Figures in the same year, which I didn't see. But, you know, she's a gifted actor. Mm. Yeah.
And the other thing that I noticed early in her early days was that often her songs were very, very difficult to sing. So if you did see her live, she wasn't, her voice wasn't necessarily able to accommodate them in the way it was on record.
Because they're sort of studio built, you know, assembled in that kind of Prince outcast.
And they're difficult. And I saw her on Jules Holland and she really screwed up Tightrope because she couldn't hit the notes and she ran off. She got upset and she ran off in the recording and she had to be coaxed back on. And now the songs she's singing are much simpler for her voice.
Yes.
So maybe somebody said, like, dial it down and then you can, you know, you can't do this stuff live. I mean, she was good live, but she, it did sometimes have a sense of slight chaos about it.
I do get the feeling that even though these songs she's produced this year, there's nothing quite as, like, immediately gobsmacking as Tightrope.
No.
You do feel like the sort of clarity of the message, the stripping down, the fact that they are about empowerment, they're about young black women, they're kind of chime with Me Too and all of that stuff, you feel like it might be her sort of moment to move up a notch or two.
It's almost like any very successful star that they attach themselves to all the trends around them and then they are still unique at the same time. It's a strange balance.
And yeah,
at the moment she is doing what people want of female pop stars. It's all about freaks and geeks and, you know, sexual liberation and bisexuality and stuff like that. And it's not about, Cindy Mayweather anymore.
No, there was a nice detail in the New York Times interview, which came out just yesterday, that because she has this Paisley Park style complex in Atlanta now, Wonderland, which you mentioned, which is quite big now, I think.
Is it big?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly described, it was sort of described as this kind of strange, semi-opulent place, a sort of black arts center in Atlanta. But Black Panther was shooting nearby. So the cast of Black Panther would come back to Janelle Monáe's Wonderland and like hang out and listen to the record in progress and dance, and Chadwick Boseman played the drums. And she said in interviews that this playing the music to the cast of Black Panther was the thing that sort of gave her the confidence to finish the record. So
this is insane. The more I think about it, the more I think she is actually an alien that had a master plan all along. Because I'm thinking, though, she's like changing with the times and stuff. But the fact that she established this place that now Black Panther, cast of Black Panther are performing in.
Yeah,
maybe she is a cyborg. I don't know.
Come to save us all.
Yeah.
Dirty Computer is out on April 27th.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The New Yorker writer Lawrence Wright wrote a book that was published in 2006 called Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. And he'd been pitched over the years by various people to turn this into a film or a series. Anyway, eventually, earlier this year, the fruits of that came to light, a series produced by Amazon and Hulu, which we are all now aware of since The Handmaid's Tale. Apparently, he only sent it to Hulu out of courtesy. He was like pitching it to Netflix and HBO and stuff.
Wow.
And he thought, well, I better send it to Hulu just for the hell of it. And they like offered him insane amounts of money, total creative freedom, you know. So he went with
them. And you can get it on, obviously, on Amazon Prime. So if you want to get your books and toiletries delivered the next day, then you might as well sign up for that, and then you get this as well.
And you can watch Looming Tower while enjoying
your toiletries. I've been watching it on your account.
Don't reveal that.
And so I realised that I could order things, but they would go to you, so it doesn't really make sense. I could buy things on your card.
You can also look at my purchasing history, which at the moment is mainly Paw Patrol pencil cases and Moana cereal
and,
bowls.
And wasn't there also like animal costumes for children?
I don't think so.
I haven't looked at it. I haven't looked at your search history.
Sounds like you have.
I thought you were getting recommendations for animal costumes.
Oh, I did. Yeah. I did get some
but
recommendations.
You haven't bought any.
I think that was around World Book Day when I was looking up costumes for my kids. In the end, I actually made a costume. I'll have you know.
What did you make?
A Cat in the Hat costume.
Wow.
Well, we assembled the costume and I made the hat. But because I'd looked for it, then I was hammered with cartoon character and book character costumes for the next few days. Back to the Looming Tower.
Mm-hmm. So it concluded last night.
So it concluded last night. The show focuses on I guess the focal point in a way is the tension between the FBI and the CIA. The CIA playing the kind of long game of trying to get to the head of Al-Qaeda, trying to track down bin Laden, and the FBI much more concerned with sort of finding the bad guys and preventing any attacks. The CIA gets sort of higher level information and just refuses to share it.
Because they feel that FBI people are basically going to explode all their careful work and destroy things.
They just arrest people, is
what
they say.
Just arrest people. The CIA just want to go in and get bin Laden. And the FBI are more concerned with, you know, smaller terrorist attacks here and there and just stopping them. So it's two different strategies.
You've got, I guess, two of the three main characters are Martin Schmidt, the CIA analyst played by Peter Sarsgaard.
Wonderfully creepy.
Incredibly creepy, bearded, sort of monkish man with a cabal of young women working for him.
Yeah, who says things like, if they're not Americans, I really don't care. Doesn't care who dies. If they're not American.
And he's sort of set up in opposition with Jeff Daniels, who plays the FBI special agent John O'Neill.
This isn't a war about one man. His people actually believe.
I have to say that I agree with John on this one.
You are making a mistake, sir.
There's simply too much risk.
Someday this administration will be remembered for the risks it didn't take.
The tide is high. Sink or swim, my only rival is within.
Bin Laden has made these threats before, but this time he put a time cap on it, saying that whatever violence awaits will occur within the next few weeks.
What I need you for is to figure out what happens next so we can stop it.
So the central character, I guess, is John O'Neill. Kate, did you find him a sort of compelling, convincing character?
He was very dramatically a kind of proper lovable rogue, priapic guy who's got two mistresses on the go at the same time as his family and drinks a lot of scotch and communicates to his male colleagues by either saying, suck me or fuck you. And that's basically what the language that he deals in.
There's this great dramatic irony hanging over him, isn't there? Because, I mean, this is sort of a spoiler, but given that this is a true story, we're going to roll with it. But, you know, the point that the whole narrative leads up to is obviously the fall of the Twin Towers. But once John O'Neill has been kicked out of the FBI, what job does he get? Security, head of security at the World Trade Center. So he's there when it happens.
And he's in the North Tower, I think.
Yeah.
And if you even just Google John O'Neill's name, who murdered John O'Neill? Like, this is the truth that's all over
serious?
This. Because, of course, isn't it convenient that he gets his job as head of security at the World Trade Center just 2 weeks before the event? And he's heard on his phone, out of danger, according to lots of different people. And then he was last seen, apparently, on floor 48, right, helping people with the evacuation. And then his body was found 10 days later in the rubble, something like that. So it's really tragic because you've been following him for, yeah, I think, best part of 10 hours. And I didn't know this story about him. I didn't really know who he was. And I just felt that it was one of the strengths of this, of the show, was that it was how kind of strangely tight it was kept on the lives of the main characters who, yes, involved in the investigation,
yeah,
and their emotional reactions, particularly to 9/11. The whole of the last episode was basically four men in different kinds of shock.
Yeah.
You know, when you see Bill Camp as Robert Chesney, as another one of those zombified figures covered in white dust that we all grew up with, walking away from the scene of the attack, I thought there was so much humanity in the way that it actually looked at their reactions.
He's a lovely character, and he bleeds humanity, doesn't he? He's got this wonderful hangdog expression. He's a quite senior FBI guy, and quite early on. I mean, one of the good things about this show is that even if you know quite a bit about 9/11, particularly if you're a bit younger, you might not know too much about the USS Cole bombing in Yemen or the attack on the US embassy in Nairobi, both of which were kind of huge, huge events. The embassy attack came on a coordinated day where they attacked multiple embassies, and I think more than 200 people were killed. Robert Chesney goes in to sort of sort this out, and as with 9/11, he's left kind of really, really scarred by it. The other brilliant character we should mention, and I noticed that the real guy is a producer on the show, so he's obviously quite involved, is Ali Soufan, who's played by Tahir Rahim, who, if anyone's seen A Prophet about 10 years ago, brilliant French film. He was
he's French Algerian, isn't he?
French Algerian, yeah.
So he's an Arabic speaker in this, and he's
one of only eight in the FBI.
Amazing. And that,
there's many things which date this, which make you realise how much America has changed since 9/11. And the other is, I'd like to know how many Arabic speakers there are in the FBI now, but it's certainly more than eight.
Yeah, one of the things that really showed me how much times have changed is that on one of the test sort of journeys that the hijackers do, Mohammed Atta just walks up to the cockpit and briefly opens the door.
Oh, yeah, and then waves to the pilot.
Waves at the pilots. And then
he says, like, oh, I thought it was the bathroom.
Thought it was the bathroom, sorry. And that is incredible. I mean, I'm not sure that they did have those little kind of concertina doors, but you could definitely get in, which is just incredible now. Robert Chesney was about to, just talking about the humanity of those.
Yeah.
Characters, he was about to retire. So at John O'Neill's retirement party with the Twin Towers strategically in the background on a boat, I think, out in the river, Chesney says that, you know, that what happened in Nairobi really shook me. I need to get out. This is it for me. And of course, the irony of then he's right in the middle of things when the Twin Towers go down, and then he's walking up with his, you know, covered in his dust and stuff. But I thought it reminded me in parts of that brilliant Paul Greengrass film United 93 in its handling of the actual attack, because there was something quiet about it. There is no recreated explosions. There is no sign of, there's no visual evidence of the death of John O'Neill, who you've been following for all this time. And there's no president. Like, Bush doesn't appear in this. He appears as himself.
The highest you get is Condoleezza Rice, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's an actor playing Condoleezza Rice, but it's actually very smart the way they weave in selectively little bits of real footage. It's very, very well done that. I think the only thing which is a slight misstep, which Rachel Cook mentioned in her review of the show for us early on in the series, is that they do struggle a little bit with the kind of peripheral characters, especially the female characters.
This is a bit like we had the same problem with Mindhunter, that the female characters are either seen pouring wine or having sex or maybe doing up a shoe.
And do you remember McMafia as well? Do you remember the girlfriend in McMafia who's just like takes everything on trust and is just like, oh, is something wrong?
Yeah, it's weird. Like Chesney goes to, he walks to John O'Neill's girlfriend's house and she has lost him that day and she obviously understands on some level that he's dead because he's left a voicemail for her that's quite ominous. But she still is able to like wipe the dust off his hands.
She sponges it.
She sponges him.
His knuckles with it, which is, and then he just goes and washes his face normally after.
Yes, she sponges him, gives him a new shirt, hugs him, and there's sort of slight suggestion of a kind of like grief eroticism in it. And then he says, I haven't been able to get hold of John all day. And she just smiles and goes over and presses this button on the answer phone. And it's like, I can't see the reality of that, you know, that reaction.
She's a weird, like, Catholic saint figure, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's really, she, I mean, she is, she, the church plays a little bit of a role in that. And they try and set up John O'Neill's faith against Ali Sufan, who is a Muslim. You know, he's not just an Arabic speaker. He's a Muslim. And there's a really... quite strong interrogation scene in the last episode in which he kind of brings to bear his knowledge of the Quran on this Al-Qaeda guy who doesn't have a clue.
In a very long extended scene in Arabic, which is great. Yeah. It's just like 15 minutes shouting in Arabic with subtitles. I do think that the director has understood that the actual visuals from 9/11 are stronger than any film footage ever made. And so there is a sort of very subtle sense of like, or literally the only way that you know it's happened is you hear a sound. And then one of the little video screens that John O'Neill's watching in his security office goes black.
Yeah.
And they just don't try and do anything else with it at all.
So The Looming Tower, all 10 episodes are up there now. It's on Amazon Prime. Last weekend, I sat down with Jim Crace at the Cambridge Literary Festival to talk about The Melody, which is Jim's 14th book, and it carries several of his trademarks, a setting that's nearly true but wholly invented, a community caught in a moment of transition, a crafted rhythmic prose, and a real sort of profound moral purpose. There's also a scheming property developer, a tabloid hack who writes with his flies open, a forest full of creatures that may or may not include Neanderthals, demons, and slug bunnies. And at the centre of the story is a character called Alfred Boussy, who's an ageing chanson singer who suffers a shocking attack one night in his seafront villa. This book is about lots of things, but it's mainly about poverty. And Jim talked a bit about how it was the idea for it came when he was staying in a very, very posh hotel at a literary festival in Chennai in India. And there was every possible luxury in this hotel, and yet they couldn't sleep at night because of the noise outside. And when they got up to look at what the noise outside was, it was the hotel bins being raided by a combination of animals and humans. So that's the seed that sparked the novel. And I'm going to play you a clip now that starts with me asking Jim about poverty and inequality and how he feels things have progressed or indeed not.
A couple of books I looked into while I was looking at poverty was Mayhew's London. And there was also a book by Jack London who came to London. And I forget the title of the book, but wrote about poverty in London in the end of the 19th century. And in detail, it's just occurring to me now, in detail, it's not very different, is it? Mm. I mean, maybe that what happens is that poverty robs you of all modern accoutrements as well, so that kind of puts you back into the 19th century. But I don't want to pretend that I'm thinking these things out like a structured piece of nonfiction. I'm not. The thing about fiction is that because it's so ancient and because we've been telling stories to each other ever since there was fires, because you cannot imagine that people would sit around a fire, you know, in primitive people would sit around a fire thousands of years ago, where we're sitting now in ancient Cambridge, with the heat of the fire on their faces and the cold of the night on their backs, and wouldn't be talking to each other about the day that they'd spent and turning into stories and turning into anecdotes. So fiction is very, very ancient. And in all of those thousands of years, it's learned lots of things and it's learned lots of tricks. And it's not to say that when you write a novel, you abandon yourself entirely to what fiction knows and take the promptings of the novel itself. But you must too, to some extent. So I feel that because my novels aren't set in a real world, you know, like I don't hold my mirror up to a real England or a real India or a real Malta, because it's my novels are largely works of the imagination, I rely more on what fiction itself can teach me than what I bring to the book myself. You know, this is not a leaflet.
Mm.
So when I started writing The Melody, I had those promptings that you described, that I described to you, but I also had lots of other promptings I haven't mentioned that for some reason or other haven't shown up in the book. So it's not me completely in control saying these are the ingredients, they've got to go in. It's not a ratatouille unless there are aubergines in it. It's what ends up is what happens. And in a way, I having written this book, I'm as baffled by it as everybody else, because it's its own thing. Mm. Of course, you have to be careful when you let novels become their own things, that you don't let them become racist or homophobic or sexist or those kind of things. But a novel never tries to be those things. It's always liberal-hearted. Fiction is always liberal-hearted. So if you abandon yourself to it, you end up with something which interests you because you can't predict where it's going. And I think that, you know, I'm going to have to read what the academics say about this novel before I can answer your question.
What do you mean by, I'm interested in fiction is always liberal-hearted. What do you mean by that? Do you mean that the very act of writing is a liberal instinct?
Well, I was just saying this just earlier this evening to Malcolm, who's in the audience somewhere, we were talking. And if you look, and this is really naive, and I'm sure you can shoot holes in it, but if you look at the really right-wing writers that we got, for example, in England, the nasty piece of work, Philip Larkin, horrible fascist Wodehouse, snobbish horror, not the other war, Evelyn Waugh. You think about what they were like as human beings and what their beliefs were, but look at their novels and their poetry, and they're much more progressive and have great sensibilities. I mean, you would not imagine from reading Larkin without knowing his background, his attitude towards women and towards black people, you will not imagine that he had those attitudes because there's so much sensibility in every single last word of all of his poems. And then you read the War Trilogy by Evelyn Waugh, and there's great feeling and sodality in those books but that you don't find in his life. And the same with Wodehouse. I mean, there's a weird way about Wodehouse that his Jeeves books are kind of anti-class as well as being pro-class because they melt the division between the classes as well as reinforcing them. And so that's interesting. And what that tells me is that there's something about literature and fiction itself that favours the underdog because that's where the stories are, that has its heart in the right place. I mean, you try and think about a reverse version of something like Cry the Beloved Country, you know, that great anti-apartheid book. It doesn't work. It can't work as a book unless it's liberal-hearted. And so I know there's going to be some examples of writers that are bastards in real life and bastards in print. but I can't for the life of me think of one. So that's what I mean. I think there's something about innate in literature which is progressive and big-hearted.
There's an afterword that you wrote to your novel Quarantine where you describe how the imp of storytelling sort of disrupted your plan for the book.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, are there other books of yours where the imp has played a sort of particularly important role? Or are there books that have proved imp-proof and have just let you get along with your plan from
no,
the beginning?
No, the thing about fiction, I said that fiction knows a few things, and a narrative by its nature knows a few things. It's wise and it's experienced, but it's also very playful and impish.
Mm.
And you might come along with all sorts of solemn ideas of what you want to do in a book, and you will be resisted very often by the book. And you have to think about it, but very often you are persuaded that the book knows better than you do, and you follow the book's ideas. So I can't think of a single book that I've written in which the imp has not played a part, except for the book that failed.
Right.
And the reason that it failed was because it was an autobiographical novel in a way, and there was no place for the imp because the truth was the truth, and it was a terrible book. Because there was no impishness in it.
Were there things in the writing of this book that surprised you?
Well, this is quite a baggy book. And I was surprised that so many... I was surprised that it was so misshapen, or maybe not misshapen, that it's such a busy book.
Mm.
Because I'm, I rely... I don't know what I'm going to write until I'm sitting down and at the desk and I'm waiting to be surprised by the book itself. That's kind of scary. You know, you're not going in with a template and saying, today I'm going to do this. You're going in with nothing except the paragraph you finished yesterday.
Mm.
And you've got to move forward and you're listening for the imp of storytelling to urge you forward. And the result of that is that my books turn out to be very schematic because I'm looking for structure all the time because there isn't any.
Right.
And so I'm like a drowning man grabbing onto anything that's solid. Whereas this book, I don't seem to have grabbed onto so many solidities. There are so many subjects in this book. It's a much less formal, schematic, tidy book than any I've written before.
Mm.
Good reason not to buy it.
No, very good reason to buy it. At one point, one of the characters talks about taking a flaneur's route around the town. And that, for me, was something of the shape of the,
yes,
the shape of the book.
Yeah.
You
should write an essay.
I will.
So we often seem to talk on this podcast about suitable music for editing. And what allows you to concentrate and what doesn't. And we both agreed that Clannad is very effective because it's so sort of spiritual and calming, and you can't necessarily work out the elvish words that are going on. And one of Tom's favourite Clannad songs is called Robin the Hooded Man, which led me to realise that it is next week, 34 years ago, that Robin of Sherwood, the TV series, hit the screens. So this was very important for you, Tom.
It was very important. 28th of April 1984, this started, although I must have watched it a bit later than that on VHS. Yeah, Robin the Hooded Man, the unmistakable haunting sounds of Clannad that opened this show. So this is like quite a gritty... gritty but quite mystical telling of the Robin Hood story. There's lots of stuff about Herne the Hunter, the sort of antler-headed sort of spirit of the forest. And there's also lots of kind of red-blooded stuff about resisting the Norman yoke, the Norman invaders, you know, the good Anglo-Saxon man standing up for his fellow men.
Why do you think it got to you so much when you were a kid?
Well, of course, I was very knowledgeable about 12th century England at that time, you know, probably about 8 or 9. No, I don't know. I think it was, we used to love the baddie, Guy of Gisborne.
Yeah.
It's such a great name, isn't it? Guy of Gisborne. This guy called Robert Addy played him. He's a blonde. He's supposed to be a real, like, he's supposed to be the Sheriff of Nottingham sort of brawn, but I guess just no one was that beefy in the 80s.
No one was that beefy. The idea of brawn in the 80s is very different.
He's like, I watched it a little bit again. He's sort of this blonde, slightly foppish guy sitting on a horse. But you know what? It's one of those things where I thought I didn't remember much about this, but then I watched the opening of the first scene on YouTube last night and I knew it word for word.
So you watched it over and over back in the day?
I must have done. Yeah, we must have done. So there's a great, you know, there's the first confrontation between Robin and Guy of Gisborne. Guy of Gisborne. And who are you, serf? I'm not a serf. I'm a free man. I say you're a serf. You're a serf. Now, what's your name, serf? I remembered that word for word. It's brilliant.
It might have been your first hearing of the word serf.
Yeah.
Maybe you were just like, what is this strange word? So would you recommend me to watch it on YouTube if it's there?
I think so. Like, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure how it would stand up. Although after we talked about it briefly about Clannad on a few podcasts ago, a couple of people got in touch to say, you know, it's amazing. I've been rewatching it, including Caroline Crampton, who edits this podcast, who was recommending me to rebuy it on DVD. but it's one of those shows where when you look up all the actors who are in it, they're like, best known for Robin of Sherwood.
Yes.
Best known for Robin of Sherwood. So, apart from Ray Winston,
Who does Ray Winston play?
Ray Winston plays Will Scarlet, one of the who becomes one of the Merry Men.
Wow.
But everyone else is kind of, this was their sort of, this was,
I think, my equivalent growing up was the BBC Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe,
mm.
which just, it sort of resonates on that deep stomach level of something yeah. that I probably would feel very confused if I watched it now, because yeah. it would take me back to being 8 years old. But yeah, there's a beauty in those, I think probably in retrospect, very low budget, very ordinary English kind of, was it made in England? Was it?
It was, yeah. It was yeah. shot in, around the north of England. I
in
think.
The rain.
Yeah. Kind of and thing. You know, it starts with a scene of sort of raping and pillaging of a village, but it's the kind of thing where it's quite effective actually, because the soundtrack, you just hear fire crackling and there's screaming, but there's just a few, now that soundtrack would be right in your face. Yeah. There'd be like, they'd have overdubbed thousands of screaming people on shouting. And it's actually quite, as you say, it's quite quiet and understated, probably just because that's all they couldn't afford 1,000 extras. But yeah, either look it up on YouTube or get yourself the DVD at Robin of Sherwood. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. Do go onto iTunes and rate us, or get in touch with us on Twitter, or, you know, email your parents about us, whatever you can, spread the word. We've been edited by Caroline Crampton, and we're going to play you out
with our song of choice week after week, a wonderful tune called Godspeed by Japanese musical troupe Pistol Jazz.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.